Hi, and welcome to another episode of To Affinity and Beyond. I'm Pete Denby, host of the show and co-founder at Hyper. Today, I'm joined by a few of my colleagues from Hyper as we explore two of our favourite subjects, data analytics and sport. We give a potted history of the use of data and analytics in sport, bring it up to date with some great modern examples of how sports teams are using data and analytics to gain competitive advantage. We look at how data and analytics can be used to enhance the fan experience. And this is recorded shortly after the final of Euro 2020. So we diagnose England's tragic loss and also give our predictions for who's going to win the Premier League next season. We hope you enjoy the show. Okay, so hi, welcome to the podcast. This is the most populated podcast we've done. So we have five of us on the podcast today, all big sports fans, I hope, and all involved in data and analytics in some form. So we'll do a round of introductions, first of all, before we get into the meat of the content. So I'll come to Dan first. So Dan Potts, Dan, what's your role within the business? What's your favourite sport and favourite team or player?
My role is an analytics consultant at Hyper. My favourite team is Manchester City. Favourite player, Phil Foden. Favourite sport, obviously football.
Right, I'll come to Tom next. So Tom Hill, what's your role, favourite sport, favourite team?
Yeah, hi, Thomas Hill, one of the directors at Hyper Group, looking after client relationships. Favourite sport is also football. I was going to say something really obscure, but I'll save that because I'm sure Damon's going to do it. Favourite team, the Mighty Foxes, Leicester City Football Club, 2015-2016 was one of the greatest years of my life, even though I've just said it was 2 years, but actually in a football season, it's classed as one.
Excellent, thank you, Tom. So we'll come to Damon next. Damon, Brian, same questions to you.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. No obscure sports from me, unfortunately. I'm football again. But yeah, my role within Hyper, I'm one of the co-founders, one of the directors. Favorite team within football is Spurs for my sins. So very pessimistic view of what's going to happen in the season coming. So yeah, that's me.
Okay, good stuff. And Tom Fothergill, same questions to you.
Yes, so like Dan, I'm an analytics consultant. But I'm also a bit of a cricket tragic, so supporting England and Yorkshire.
Cool. At least it's not all football.
Yeah, you're the odd one out, Tom, sorry. So just to complete the pack, so Peter Denby, also a director at Hyper, favourite sport, football, favourite teams, a combination of Man United and Scunthorpe United. So I am the original glory supporter and started supporting Man U just about the time they were getting good under Alex Ferguson. But Scunthorpe was my boyhood team. So we're recording the podcast a few days after England's horrible defeat in the final of the Euros. So how's everyone feeling about that?
Still really deflated, to be honest. Yeah. It was a very morbid Monday this week, probably the most morbid Monday I've ever been part of. So yeah, really deflated. I'm not one of those that thinks that we're going to win the World Cup in Qatar either. I thought we did a really good job, in terms of probably got further than I thought we would do. But yeah, I think the heat in Qatar, we've got no chance. So a little bit deflated, but to be honest, probably quite footballed out this year. Premier League, you saw every game. There was nothing else to do while we were locked down. Went straight into the Euros. Ultimate disappointment being a Spurs and England fan. So yeah, footballed out.
Yeah, I think all of us are probably very disappointed with the result. Unlike many who seem to, one defeat, criticise everybody that could possibly get involved. I think for all of Southgate's restrictions as a manager, I think his man management is outstanding of that England team, and the players are clearly playing for him, which is nice to see. And I think that the players did us proud, and I was absolutely devastated for Saka when he missed his penalty and watching his reaction. For a young man of 19 years of age to step up, take that penalty kick, and then when I watched him burst into tears, I just wanted to give him a hug myself, and I'm glad Southgate did. And secondly, he had such an amazing breakthrough tournament. It was a shame that it had to be him, but I guess he'll learn from that, and hopefully he comes back stronger because he looks like a right talent for Arsenal. Mm. Sorry, Damon.
Controversial opinion, but I didn't think Saka was that brilliant during the tournament.
I thought he had
a good game, one good game, and tailed off.
I think you're very wrong there, but Luke Shaw was my player of the tournament.
Definitely. Shaw, Bertrand Carlos was unbelievable. Unbelievable throughout that tournament.
He was good, and Phil Foden promised much and then, again, disappeared. What happened, Dan?
Well, I think in the first game, you saw Phil dropping in quite a bit. And I'm not sure if Southgate liked that because he was then bumped out of the team, wasn't he? I think that's when Saka got his opportunity. I think, given time, Phil, through like the youth academy at City, has always played central. Always trying to find space. He's obviously a slight player, so he needs to find that space around people. But on the ball, technically, his vision is unbelievable. I think I disagree with Damon. I reckon by the World Cup in Qatar, that team at Southgate has started to form, and the experience that they've just gained, the young players in that team are only going to go from strength to strength. And I think by the time Qatar rolls around, a couple of extra additions, maybe Mason Greenwood, Fikayo Tomori, Ben Godfrey, you're looking at a really dangerous England team for the next 10 years.
Maybe it's the optimism of youth there, Dan.
Maybe.
I don't think you're thinking about the weather, mate. I really don't.
And English people melt after 22 degrees.
Yeah. It's all right. They've said they're going to come up with some brand new invention where they're going to cool down a whole stadium somehow, some way. So I'm sure we'll be fine.
Yeah. I hope we win. I hope we're at least in and around the semis and final, but... Yeah, I just can't see it. But there are some good players there. I think they'll come of age, a lot of those players. Well, they come of age, it's only in a year's time, isn't it? But a lot of them have had that experience of being in a big tournament and we'll know some of the pitfalls that they might come across in the next tournament, and hopefully they take that on board and do better this time.
I think for me it just feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. You know, I think everything kind of fell nice in our favour. Obviously we played well, but the draw was very, very friendly. You know, France got knocked out. And some of the squads probably weren't as strong as they have been in previous competitions. It's a bit disappointing, but I think they played well. Did England proud, I'd say.
Yeah, I think the team in general did everybody proud. I think the way they conducted themselves with all the, you know, all the awful stuff that happened after the game. And Southgate definitely conducted himself brilliantly and got the spirit within the camp, which is been massively missing in previous tournaments. The first one I can remember was 1986, showing my age, the World Cup in Mexico, but 1990 was the biggest one that I can remember. I was old enough to completely remember what was going on. And the teams back then, Bobby Robson and you know, he had a good team spirit, and then Venables at Euro 96, really good team spirit, but then they went on a really real downward spiral after that. I think, you know, bringing in some of the managers that necessarily didn't get what creating that kind of spirit meant to the English team, and I think you could see that in some of the results. And you know, I do think that we overperformed, which is testament really to Gareth Southgate and what he did with the team.
Yeah. All right, good stuff. So we'll move on now, guys, to the topic for the podcast, which is the use of data analytics in sport. And it's risen to prominence recently, and I think, well, as we talk through this, you know, we'll talk about some of the examples of where data and analytics has been used to great effect within sport. But let's just think back over time and how things have evolved. So, Dan, what's your view about, you know, how data and analytics have been used, you know, through the ages in sport?
So I think the best place to start is something familiar and something that most people are familiar with is Moneyball. So Moneyball is based off the idea that within baseball, they call this data sabermetrics, which is essentially the recording of event data. So it's similar to like a completed pass in a game of football. Now, the earliest example of sabermetrics were credited to a chap named Henry Chadwick, and he developed what we call the box score in 1858. To start off with, it only recorded two statistics. It was for the offensive team, because we needed to know the number of runs and the number of times each batter was out. From this point, fan interest actually drove the expansion of the metrics. So he started including defensive statistics, and a lot of them, when I had a look, having never played baseball, never watched baseball, I don't have a clue what the vast majority of them are. But over time, as more interest gets put on data and people want to read more into the game and feel more connected to what they're watching, Modern day box scores record a number of runs per player per innings, as well as number of errors, total bases, which they record from single runs, double runs, triple runs, home runs. They also record people that are stealing bases, and that's just a small selection of what we do these days. Then it starts getting into more recording fielding positions of players and batting roles of individual players, so as well as the changes that are occurring mid-game. So now you can actually build up a really good idea of what's happening mid-game, what's changing tactically, who's been put on for what reasons. From this point in 2002, Billy Beane and the Oakland Athletics, they leveraged this data in recruitment to identify players that they believed matched their vision to win games, which was getting on base. With one of the lowest budgets in Major League Baseball, they identified players that weren't highly sought after, but the data suggested they would perform for the team by looking at their on-base percentage. They had huge success, and this really started turning heads. So in the sporting world, people are now thinking about what data can we collect from the games, how can we analyse these players' performances, team performances, opposition play, how can we use this data within recruitment strategies, even using tracking data within training for sports science purposes to look after the high-value assets. And all of this is just in an effort to gain that little bit of edge in the most competitive stages in the world. Focusing on the world of football, where we all feel a little bit more comfortable probably, the earliest analytics can be credited to a man called Charlie Reap. So he was unhappy with his team's performance in a game, and this was in 1950. So he just started jotting down observations and trends he could spot with the naked eye during the game. His conclusions were really simplistic in that there was a large ratio between attacks and goals. So as a fan of playing long balls with his team, aka hoofball, he hypothesised that less passing was actually needed between players and people should just be looking to play the ball forward as often as possible instead of a more measured approach revolving around ball retention.
He Is believed... that Sam Allardyce's granddad, by the way?
It could be, couldn't it? It sounds exactly like what he'd like. So he believed that plays with three or fewer passes were more effective, but most play involved three or fewer passes anyway, so it was a bit of a biased conclusion that fit his ideals of how football should be played. He also recorded this data in a way that he thought was best, but since it's been proven by a lot of people, he discarded a lot of important information, such as like high volumes of passing play, work the ball into an advanced area, and then that resulted in a dead ball. And from the dead ball, the players made three or fewer passes and then scored a goal, which would then fit his assumption that three or fewer passes were better than having a slow measured approach in the build-up. So, in essence, his data collection was a little bit limited by his time and the technology available to him. Since this time, the ability to collect large amount of data across thousands of the games and having the computing power to analyse the data has really revolutionised data science within football. Whereas Charlie Reap collected small amounts of biased data that confirmed his assumptions, these days more standardised metrics and the boom of event and tracking data is allowing clubs of all sizes to leverage this insight to work towards their sporting philosophy of how the game should be played, which is very similar to the way that Billy Beane set up the Oakland Athletics back in 2003.
So I just think that point then about the kind of biased samples is really interesting, because I was reading about Brentford and the way they use data. And when they're using it for scouting, they want their data guys basically to not look at clips of the players that they're assessing. And they want the scouts not to actually look at the data of the players that they're trying to assess, just to try and avoid that kind of biased assumption. You know, I like this player, so I'm going to try and find some data that proves how good he is. So I think it's really interesting to see that kind of point.
Of course, Football Manager has completely revolutionised it now, hasn't it? Everybody can see the stats. And you know, some managers actually buy players off the strength of how they do on Football Manager.
It's interesting as well, because we've talked quite a lot about the history and the movement of analytics in sport during sort of Dan's points there. But where it's going to go, and we've seen this in other markets, and I think sport's going into this place as well, which is we now have this wealth of player data, and we understand how a player's performing within a game, what their stats are, how they're moving physically and how they're performing. And that data is available, and it's available to a lot of people, and it can be monetized. So we've seen data monetized certainly within retail a lot. So retailers sharing advertising space and targeting that to specific customers is one of the ways it's been done. But exactly the same thing's happening in sport, and it's going to be very interesting, the moral discussion around who owns that data. So it's yeah, it'd be interesting to sort of hear a few more points later and where that's going.
The openness of publishing of data is interesting as well. You know, I follow cycling as well as football closely, and there's a lot of talk about people publishing or not publishing their data. The guy who's leading the Tour de France at the moment, as we record this, Pogacar, hasn't published his power data, which is probably harks back to the dubious past that cycling has and some of the suspicions that dominant athletes kind of rouse. But So, you know, not publishing data sometimes can, you know, lead to the wrong assumptions. Whereas publishing it, you know, some people, well, his reason for not publishing the data is that he doesn't want to give away a competitive advantage so that his fellow riders can see when he's, you know, putting extra power down and not. So, yeah, publishing data and its availability, I think, is interesting. You'd be nice if all data was kind of freely available so that it was that more level playing field. And then, you know, whoever can really excel at using analytics to benefit from that data kind of comes to the fore.
Yeah, the power levels, again, with data sharing, and that happens in other industries. So everyone sees the benefit of knowing how a market is performing. But in other industries and sport, being the really obvious one of Formula One, the every little tiny edge that you think you can get through your analysis of your data means that it's gone the other way and people don't want to share anything and it's become really secretive. And I think that's the case in quite a lot of sport at the minute, that people have more the belief that if they share their data, they're giving away a competitive advantage rather than gaining from the advantage of knowing what other people are doing as well, which isn't necessarily true.
And Damon, you mentioned Sam Allardyce, so the much maligned Sam Allardyce. Was he actually a genius ahead of his time in his use of data and Prozone?
Yeah, he used it a lot, didn't he? I think he certainly got, you know, better results than a lot of people probably expected. And, you know, against the style that he actually played. So I thought he was a bit of a pioneer, to be honest, with Sam Allardyce, with that, you know, with the use of the data and understanding how he can get the best out of players and how he can get that directness, you know, when they're playing football to ultimately leading a goal. So, yeah, he did okay with all that stuff.
And Bolton punched way above their weight, didn't they? He's obviously managed a few teams since, but he did incredibly well with Bolton in the 90s and brought some kind of aging superstars to the club and kept them playing into their, you know, late into their 30s. Hierro, and he had a Kotcher and various others. So, you know, actually, I think before loads of people cottoned on to, you know, the benefits of using data and analytics, he did that really successfully. Okay, so we'll move on to talk about some of the use cases for data and analytics in sport. And I think player recruitment is a big one, and it's definitely front of mind. Now we're in the close season of the Premier League, waiting for it all to start up again. So, Tom F, what's your views on using data and analytics for player recruitment?
Yeah, so I think one of the really interesting uses is in kind of benchmarking different leagues. So it's used quite a lot in cricket. So the way that cricket works is that there's kind of multiple tournaments around the world, and a player can quite feasibly play in kind of three or four different countries in the same year. You know, so in summer they could play in England, then go and play in the Pakistan Super League through the autumn. You know, play in Australia in the winter, and then in India in spring. So what that means is that you can actually kind of gauge how a player's performance varies by which competition they're playing in. And then once you do that over the kind of the whole player base, you can get a really good idea of the kind of relative standard of each different league. And so this has actually been used in football as well to find kind of leagues that are being undervalued. I know that Leicester and Brentford have really kind of signed a lot of players from the second league in France. So I know Tom will tell you about Kante and Mahrez, and there's countless other examples of kind of players that have come from these leagues that are undervalued, based on the fact that, you know, these clubs know that these leagues are actually better than a lot of people think they are. Likewise, Brentford have signed a lot of players from Scandinavia, and it's no surprise that Salzburg that signed Erling Haaland from Scandinavia. They're one of the kind of the foremost teams in their use of data, you know, very forward-thinking club.
And is that for Tom Hill, is Leicester still kind of following that strategy of trying to recruit from undervalued leagues find hidden gems, or have the other clubs kind of cottoned onto that and caught up now?
Well, I think the other clubs have catching on and are catching up. We looked at the French second division quite a lot, and obviously Kanté and Mahrez came in, and what an unbelievable success they turned out to be. I mean, Kanté's been probably one of, if not the best player in his position that there's ever been. So that's definitely something that we did. It's changing, and I think the market that we're operating in brilliantly as a Leicester fan has slightly changed, in that we're less willing to take as bigger risks as we did when we recruited those guys. Don't forget that Kanté was our first season, well, second season in the Prem, and Mahrez had been with us in the Championship. So was it 600,000, 400,000, I can't remember what it was for Mahrez. Is unbelievable. But I feel like we're stretching it out, but we've just signed a striker from the Austrian leagues, Daka. So be interested to see how he does, because I think the principles are the same. We're almost looking to find players that aren't proven yet in the major leagues, so the German league, the Spanish league and the Prem, and then take those. And it takes a bit of time to integrate them. And it'll be interesting to see whether we can continue with that success. We signed Fofana last year, who has been unbelievable and won't be at Leicester for very much longer. But that's a great example that we're still doing it and it's still working. But one of the things that I think you've got to have if you're doing that is time for bedding in. So it took Mahrez, what people don't realise, probably a season and a half to adapt to the English game. Kanté just landed and was unbelievable from day one. But I think that's harder to do with this sort of approach to recruitment.
Okay. I mean, you'd think that people would catch up, the other clubs would catch up and they'd kind of close that advantage. But I think we know from other industries that it's not always that simple. You know, a large football clubs, Premier League football clubs in particular, are large businesses as well as football clubs. And for a large business to start doing something that's very new to them, it just isn't straightforward. There's a lot of things that have to happen to do it and then get good at it. So, you know, perhaps there is another few years where the people who have pioneered using data and analytics for better recruitment, you know, where they'll still have that advantage before it eventually becomes commonplace.
Yeah, and it's really difficult, isn't it, getting the balance, especially in football. Stats, you know, they tell you so much, but as we know, footballers can be precious souls, and just a simple arm around them can turn them into absolute world beaters when they clearly weren't doing anything at the previous club. I think most footballers in the major leagues around Europe have got that much talent, but to get that cutting edge and take them to that next level, you know, there's many things involved in it, and using stats and data is a really good way to try and understand if somebody's got that within them to go to that next level.
And Pete, I'll pick up on the point that you made there, which is there are multiple factors and stats can tell you quite a lot. But if you've not got a strategy, and that's the same in any other industry, if you've not got an overarching strategy that your club is organised around, bringing in a player who is a brilliant player but doesn't necessarily fit into the style of play that a manager wants, it won't work. You can have the best data science in the world and you can think you're bringing in a great player, but it won't integrate into the team because that overarching strategy is not there. I think one thing Leicester have done very well has been clear about the style of play that we want to play, the players that we need to play that, and then working. And it was much maligned, if you remember, when Rodgers was at Liverpool, the transfer committee. But now Rodgers, in essence, gives the scouting team a brief. This is the player I need to make my strategy work within the team, and that's where data comes into it. So the brief has to be right, and the player has to be right.
Yeah, and I think certainly, well, in football, maybe in football, probably less so in some of the American starts, which are more stop start. But in football, because it's such kind of live action with relatively few kind of cold starts, apart from maybe, you know, throw-ins and corners and free kicks, it's how commonly you apply analytics, because you don't want people to overthink things. So there's got to be a place for using analytics in the, you know, in the right part of the game, so people aren't, you know, don't have too much going through the head and can actually let their natural talent kind of take them a certain way, rather than, you know, getting confused with a decision that they need to make because the stats have told them that it's more effective if they pass, you know, to the left than the right.
Completely agree, Pete. And I think, you know, when you look back into business outside of sport, the data and stats, if you go too detailed, things can get confusing. It's about simple outputs, isn't it? And it's the same in sport. It's about saying, right, there's a very simple thing you can do and what the stats are telling you as an individual player that will make such a difference to your game. And it's just keeping it simple, I think, for people to understand that and mix that with their raw talent and raw instinct to go to that next level.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, Tom F., back to you again. Are there other areas, so maybe more on the kind of strategy side of use of data and analytics that you've come across that you've found particularly interesting?
Yeah, so like Dan mentioned, obviously the kind of Moneyball star is the classic. There's also kind of parallels in basketball. So it's a guy called Daryl Morey, who was kind of computer scientist by trade. He worked at EY as a consultant and eventually kind of got into sports strategy and became the GM of Houston Rockets. Some of the kind of things that he did was look for inefficiencies in the way that they were playing. And one of the areas they looked at was shot locations. So what he found was just a kind of brief outline of how basketball works. So in basketball, there's a kind of an arc about 20 feet from the basket called the three-point line. Any shots from within the arc, you get 2 points, and any shots from without is 3 points. So what he found was that shots taken from kind of mid-range, so not right underneath the basket, but still within that two-point area, were basically just as likely to go in as three-point shots were. Yeah, so his kind of hypothesis was, why are we taking all these shots that are only worth 2 points when we can basically take equal probability shots, you know, that'll get us 3 points? So that was his kind of his basic strategy, and it's completely revolutionised the game of basketball. So I've got the stats here. So in 2007, which is when he became the GM of the Houston Rockets, there was an average of 16 three-point attempts per team per match. In the last season, it was about 35. So that's across all teams. It's more than doubled. So it's completely changed the game, and it's kind of brought this new generation of players who play in a completely different style to everybody else, based purely on this kind of small inefficiency that he found and was able to exploit.
That's quite telling, isn't it? That is quite a difference. And I think use of data and analytics is probably more advanced in American sports, isn't it? I know, you know, Dan's spoken about Moneyball and in baseball. I know it's used heavily in the NFL and like you've just said, Tom, in basketball, in the NBA as well. And how about in cricket, your favourite? Do you see examples of data and analytics being used to great effect in cricket?
Yeah, so it kind of all started in cricket when Hawkeye came along. So Hawkeye is the kind of the ball tracking technology. So kind of every ball now in international cricket is tracked, so you can see the speed, the swing, spin, you know, the location, where it's bounced, and obviously how many runs are scored, whether there was a wicket, whether there was a chance created. And that really like allows you to kind of build up this really detailed picture of the actual game. So you can imagine if you're playing against a team and you know that a batsman's coming in who is a brilliant player, but he struggles against fast, short bowling at his body. You know, as a captain, you know what you need to do. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, great captains of the past might have had a kind of inkling that, you know, this is how we go at the batsman, but it's kind of allowed every team to have that kind of really optimized strategy and really kind of quite personalized as well. So you can actually go at each individual batsman with what their weakness is, and you can really target quite individually.
Are there any particular teams within cricket? I'm not as familiar with cricket as football, but any particular teams who've kind of pioneered using data and analytics?
So England are one of the best, and they've got a guy called Nathan Lehman, who's just written a really good book, actually. And he's a Cambridge maths graduate, and he's obviously worked with loads of other club teams around the world. But yeah, so England are really at the forefront of that kind of thing. And they've actually started using things like sort of flashcards. So the analyst will be sat on the balcony and he'll hold up like a number or a letter, just kind of letting the captain know, like a coded kind of strategy. So there's loads of like really interesting new strategies being used.
Excellent. Good stuff. And another area that's perhaps less well exploited so far is more on the commercial area, actually, and fan experience. So Damon, have you how have you found that? Have you come across clubs that have, you know, used data and analytics to deliver great fan experiences, or do you think that's an area of untapped potential?
Yeah, I definitely think it's an area of untapped potential. There are some clubs that are starting to really use data to optimize fan experiences. I've been to the Allianz Arena by Munich's ground, and they're a club that's starting to use technology to make it better, to, you know, when you're inside the stadium and creating a better experience. But I think it's an interesting topic, really, because the last 18 months, I guess, have been really difficult for sports clubs that have relied heavily on fans attending their stadiums. Many professional sports clubs these days are huge businesses also. And the pandemic has impacted each and every club adversely, no matter how big or small. So now more than ever, it's hugely important that clubs can harness data and analytics to engage with fans better and better to enhance their experiences, whether at home watching on TV or whether back in a sports stadium as well. I think the last few years, I've seen major advancements in technology that have massively enhanced the at-home experience for fans. You know, fans have had more and more options available to them to watch their favourite team or sports event in, you know, Ultra HD these days. I think I saw a stat the other day that said over 80% of home watchers claim that they had multiple devices switched on whilst they're watching TV, whether that's interacting with things like in-play betting, in-play stats, whilst also just chatting to their mates, you know, on WhatsApp or whatever, whilst they're watching the game. I think the big challenge for sporting clubs, particularly as we see the pandemic restrictions start to ease, is getting fans back into the stadiums too. There's going to be an inevitable rush of fans into stadiums over the next few months because, you know, people have been missing out. People want to get back to live sports and live events. But how do clubs keep their stadiums full on a week-by-week basis? I think a lot of these clubs are still wondering how they do that. And the monetization opportunity for remote experiences remains huge, aside from just the TV money, but major clubs drag in huge amounts of revenue from fans being in stadiums, just from ticket revenue alone, and the opportunity for maximizing revenues from other sources whilst in the stadium through optimization of this fan experience is something that most clubs are nowhere near doing, in my experience. That said, though, I think the balance is also a fine one. Fans of clubs aren't stupid. They realise that they need to be run as businesses to stay alive these days. And, you know, we've lost some amazingly traditional football clubs through finances, you know, over the past few years, which is such a real shame. And I think fans also want to remain engaged with the club and not just be seen as a pound sign. So clubs need to find this balance, really, of monetising their data assets by enhancing the fan experience so they continue to feel valued and part of the club. And I just wanted to touch on a few opportunities, really, that clubs have to utilise data and analytics in a very effective way whilst fans are in the stadium. We all know that the kind of at-home experience and the power of advertising across all these channels is still huge for football clubs and sporting clubs. But it's whilst, you know, whilst fans are in the stadium that's key, really. This obviously also relies heavily on utilising advancements in technology. Some examples, really. I think smart stadiums are becoming a thing. So making the use of IoT, 5G and Wi-Fi and digital signage are all readily available to most clubs. But I think the question is, how do they utilise this technology aligned with fans' personal devices? So not just, you know, screens in the stadium, but actually how do they utilise personal devices to maximise engagement? An example of this could be things like augmented reality to augment stats onto players in real time as their fans point their devices at them at the games. I think there's some companies that are starting to do that. And also the gamification, really, of the fan experience. So things such as fantasy football whilst you're in the stadium, or you know, games such as like Beat the Manager or other fans with your predictions around things like player stats, score lines, possession, when subs will be made, etc. There's loads of interesting options available to them. And of course, then we get onto things like the monetization of fan data, whether that's through you know, personal devices in an app or whether it's digital signage within inside the stadium through sponsors and brands. Brands are much more likely to spend marketing money if their message is targeted at the right people at the right time across multiple channels, not just within screens or advertising banners on the pitch. Which then, of course, brings us onto the inevitable personalization of communications and offers to fans, whether it's for refreshments, products for brands and sponsors, and available to purchase within the stadium or actually outside of the stadium. And I think also technology and data can create ease for fans in a big way. I think we see this a lot more on the continent than we do in UK stadiums, to be honest. But easy and quick payments for refreshments, order before half time, pick up quickly or order direct to your seat would, in my opinion, massively enhance the experience. Nobody likes queuing for a pint and a pie at half time, do they? When they've got to, you know, get it down them within 30 seconds so you don't miss the start of the second half. And I think optimising operations within stadiums is a huge opportunity for clubs to maximise its experience and getting fans wanting to come back for more. I'm only just really scratching the surface, really, with all this. I think the opportunity is huge for most major clubs. They're only just getting started with harnessing the data they're collecting.
Fantastic. I think listeners have just witnessed Hyper's pivot to a sports analytics business. I like the opportunity.
Well, Pete, can you remember the idea we had around Pep Talk?
I do, yeah.
Which was an AI-based game whereby you could try and beat Pep at his own game and, you know, be a better manager than Pep. Unfortunately, it's not been taken to production yet, but we've still got big hopes for that idea, haven't we, Pete?
We have, and our equivalent for Arsenal, a tête-à-tête. That's still on the cards, copyright.
Yeah. Anything we're discussing here is obviously copyrighted and nobody can
exactly.
use.
But building on that point, Damo, as we talked about monetization, I think it'd be really interesting to see how player data gets used. So you talked about gamification, and if players are willing for their data to be shared with the likes of betting companies, who owns the rights to that? I think you'll definitely have agreements with clubs which are like image rights today. Who owns your image rights? Who owns my data rights?
Yeah.
And what you're willing to give away and what you're not willing to give away for money. But as we always find in most situations, as long as it doesn't isn't detrimental to you, you're likely to happily sell that data.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, more and more you're seeing, aren't you, on job advertisements on LinkedIn or whatever, football clubs recruiting for heads of analytics and data analysts. And I think that's testament, really, with the, you know, to show you where clubs' thinking is with regards to being able to harness that, not just for fan experience, but for monetizing, you know, a different way of getting money, because I think most clubs need it these days.
And I think that kind of nicely brings us on to the next point, which is around the war for talent. So, you know, we know from personal experience that, you know, really skilled data and analytics staff and data scientists are pretty tough to come by. So as the sporting clubs enter the market as well, what does that mean? Maybe one for Tom Hill, you know, how can they compete with all the other large organisations that are looking for this special type of talent?
Well, at the top of the game, money. It's the same way they get the best players. It's been really interesting watching the transition, really, from using agencies for data and analytics in sport, and then to the point we made before, clubs wanting to have their own data analysts and wanting to keep their own solutions to themselves for sort of secrecy and that upper hand. I think the best explanation of this is Man City versus Liverpool and their recruitment strategies from a data perspective in recent times. We mentioned Sam Allardyce earlier. I think we didn't mention the natural transition from Sam Allardyce to Arsene Wenger. Very similar in style and demeanour. But Arsene Wenger's also one of the people, isn't he, that a proponent, a pioneer of analytics in sport in its infancy. Well, I say sport, sorry, in football.
His nickname was the Professor, wasn't it, Tom? I think
Arsene yeah.
Wenger.
Yeah, and that
amongst other things that we won't mention on here.
But again, in that time, it was more agency based. I think those guys used StatDNA as a company, and they pitched what they could offer to Wenger around player analytics for scouting and game management and how players would fit into his system. But now it's moved, and I think it's moved, and we'll use Man City and Liverpool as examples. So, Man City's latest recruitment in terms of their lead AI data scientist is a guy called Laurie Shaw. And a PhD in astrophysics, so this is a football club bringing somebody in who's an astrophysicist. He worked in banking, I think, so he worked in developing trading systems and algorithms, which in essence know whether it's a good time to make a trade or not. There's loads of real-time data used in that, looking at the markets, all of the factors within the markets. There's loads of attributes. And in essence, all you're doing is the same thing. Should I make a trade or not? Should I buy a stock for this price? It's should I buy a player based on all their attributes that they've got? So you can see the transition, and I think he was a policy advisor to the government as well. So it's a very odd role to be bringing into Man City, but in essence, he's a scientist, a proper scientist, who they're willing to bring in to leverage those types of techniques to apply them to football. And as I just sort of mentioned, the techniques are the same. So football's moved on a lot recently with, and I've forgotten what we talked about before in basketball, but in terms of the probability of scoring a point from a different position, well, that's just XG in football now. And expected goals are what's the likelihood of me scoring from this position on a football pitch? And that's becoming a more important stat than actual goals, because as long as your striker is there and putting the ball in the net, then the goals will come. And yeah, so those guys are leading that. And Liverpool are in a similar battle. So they brought in a lead data scientist. I forgot the name of the first person, but William Spearman now, again, studied physics, did a PhD at Harvard, and I think particle physics within that. So a lot of work around that. And he's now in a football club. Those guys are building up their own data science teams, and those data science teams are looking at all those stats and all those attributes, player attributes, body movement, and everything that we can collect now. So biometrics of a player, what's their heart rate, what's their sort of physical, what's their gait as they're running, do they look like they're tiring during a game, are we substituting them at the right time, should it be earlier, should it be later, combined with all the other information just around where positionally and pass tracking, am I playing the right pass at the right time? Speaking to a guy who's closely involved in football analytics, he said that they're developing models to think about what the right pass is to optimise expected goals, working with Manchester City. And when he was talking, he said that the model showed you which pass should be played so that you're going to have the biggest opportunity to score a goal at the end of it. And that model always be all the players in terms of the passes that they played. But when you were scouting, they looked for players who were playing those types of passes. So especially wherever Aguero is, you want to make sure that you put the ball in a place probably just in front of him that he's going to stick it in the net. But one player beat the model and basically played a better pass where the expected goal was less but resulted in more goals. And that player was David Silva. So it just shows that a genius can still beat a data model. But that's the movement, and that's the way things are going. And there is a massive talent race of football clubs at the top hoovering up what they believe to be top talent, not in football, but in analytics, and applying that to football and bringing in different skills from different areas. But then there's now just a movement of data science in sport. So when I was at university a few years ago, but basically it was called management science in those days, and operational research, but ultimately data science, you learnt data science. There are now courses at universities which are sports analytics and technology, data science for sports, sports analytics, MSCs, masters, and it's becoming its own industry. And that's because the demand's there for people to be understanding the techniques to optimise all the things that we've just talked about, scouting, performance on a pitch, in terms of making sure that you're more likely to score a goal, shoot a hoop. That's what they say in basketball, isn't it, Tom? It's probably not anymore, is it?
I'm not sure.
If they're an idiot, maybe.
anyway, yeah, but basically you can see there that that's how it's going, and top data scientists are now being scouted by top clubs, and they're recruiting data scientists to do it, and it's still hard to get that type of talent in there. So yeah, I expect that race and that war to continue in terms of people getting in data scientists to lead those areas within football clubs.
Well, it's a fascinating area. It's come a long way since, you know, when we probably all started watching football a few years ago. You know, becoming very advanced now, and there's definitely going to be a talent war. Okay, so I think we've covered some brilliant areas. It's a fascinating topic. We could probably talk all day about this, especially since sports is our kind of passion, combined passion, and we work in the field of data and analytics. So I'm going to finish off the podcast with a non-analytical prediction. So I'm going to ask each one of you who you think is going to win the Premier League this year and why. I'm going to start with Tom Hill.
First, the obvious answer is Man City. I don't see them getting any weaker. Liverpool are struggling to strengthen their midfield. But I'm just going to go random and say Chelsea, because they can start signing lots of players again. I thought they were building a decent team towards the end of last season, and the manager's clearly doing a really good job there. So when I talk about strategy, I feel like Chelsea are starting to get a strategy together, and that might be successful for them this year.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to come to you next.
I think sticking on the topic of strategy, the obvious answer is Manchester City. Since the owners have come in and we had maybe a couple of years of sporadic buying of players which didn't fulfil the potential, we've had a really clear vision. Pep Guardiola already knows that if you want to remain at the top, you've got to keep churning out players, you've got to keep it fresh. That's the strategy that we're going to go for again this season. We'll see some heavy recruitment probably. It's striker position, hopefully. If you think last year we played without a recognised number nine and still really walked the league towards the end of it, I can't see past Man City again for the title. I think if you look at the nearest contenders, I think Chelsea might be closer than Liverpool this season, based off the little boost they'll get from Tuchel and winning the Champions League. But in terms of winning the league, I mean, we've had a strategy for the last 5-6 years since Pep's come in, and he's played some of the best football I've ever seen. And he's picked up a lot of records on the way, so I expect that to continue.
Okay, Damon, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's notoriously hard, isn't it, to win two in a row, back-to-back titles. But I do think Man City are going to win it again.
Not Spurs, Damon.
No, not Spurs. I mean, this could be our worst season for a long time. We've had it good at Tottenham, really, over the last, probably the last like decade. It's been pretty good. I remember in the 90s and the early 2000s, we were terrible. But yeah, I think wherever Harry Kane goes as well might have a big... might have a big impact on who does really well this season. I think it's likely he'll go to either Man City or Man United, but he could really take Man United to the next level. But I do think Man United aren't going to win much as long as Ollie's at the wheel, as the fans like to say. yeah, but I'll have to go Man City. Boring answer, but okay. Yeah.
Tom F.
Man City for me as well. Yeah, I just think their style of play just suits beating the smaller teams so efficiently. They just kind of beat them with ease, and you can just rack up points. I think they're the best team by a long, long way.
And unfortunately, I think Man City as well. I think they are the best team, definitely. They've got the best manager, play excellent football. They've got so much going for them, really well-run club as well. I'd love it to be Man United, but I agree with Damon. I think we probably need a manager who's another notch up. And I think Liverpool could implode because I think their forward line are going to start getting cheesed off. Salah's going to leave, Mane's going to leave, and, you know, that'll be the end of their brief period of dominance. Yeah.
Of course, Liverpool fans will think as soon as Van Dijk's back, and then that's it, they're back to winning the league or walking the league. But, yeah, very deluded fans.
Until Jordan Pickford takes him out again. Back to square one. All right, brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, guys. Really enjoyed that. And thanks for listening, everyone. Many thanks to my guests this week, Dan Potts and Tom Fothergill, for their very first appearance on the podcast, and also regulars Damon Bryan and Tom Hill. If you like what you heard today, then please do check out the archive of podcasts. We've had some cracking guests on the show. And if you'd like to understand more about what Hypergroup does, please contact me at peter@hyper-group.co.uk or check out our website, www.hyper-group.co.uk. Keep a lookout for the next episode dropping in about a week's time. And until then, thanks for listening.